Hi everybody, it's Paul here for next day Q&A. It's not actually the next day, but it's close enough to it. I think today's Thursday and we did this thing on Saturday. So we're going to take the time to do a sound check because we've got a minute before starting time. So Carly Campbell, I'm wondering if you can hear us down there in Melbourne, mate.
Yes, I can.
Oh, cool. Were you with us on Saturday?
No, I wasn't, but I've listened to most of the recording.
Oh, okay, cool. So this will be a pretty good review. Thanks for that. We'll let's go to, because it's just sound check, let's go to Sydney. We'll talk to see if Terry Cole can hear us. So, hey, Terry.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, mate. And you?
Not bad, thank you.
Cool.
Enjoying not breathing no smoke today.
I was going to say, what's the go in Sydney?
Well, the smoke's cleared since Tuesday, but Tuesday was pretty dreadful.
Yeah, I heard all sorts of stuff about people closing buildings, closing schools, all sorts of things.
Oh, yeah, you just couldn't. If you left anything open, the smoke just got right through.
Yeah, amazing.
And it didn't clear till about 7 o'clock after the wind had been blowing for 2 hours. So.
Right. Yeah, 2.7 million hectares of bush on fire.
Yeah, it's amazing. When you look at the fires near me, it's just all over.
Mm. Yeah, cool. Thanks for that.
No worries.
We'll keep moving. Michael Tudor, how are you going? See what the weather's doing in Tweed Heads. If Michael's near his microphone. Hello, Michael.
Yep, just trying to find the unmute button. Yeah, I'm good. I'm good.
Yeah, it's hidden behind the bloody whatever it is. Okay, so we're not coming through nice and clear for you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. I'm not going to ask you what the weather's doing in Tweed Heads because we're just up the road. We just had a shower.
Yeah, we haven't had the rain yet, but it's due.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. Last night we had, in Brisbane at least, there was the same amount of rain as it has been in the last 6 months in an hour and a half.
Yeah, I heard that. Cars getting swept down the streets and everything.
Yeah, yeah. We had clients driving home from our fast track gig. One of them saying, if I hadn't bought a new Benz, there's no way I could have been able to drive.
Yeah.
There you go. Nice ad for Mercedes.
Yeah.
All right. We better get going because I don't know how I'm going to fit this into an hour. So we're going to launch. Hi to Hilton Gibson down there in Adelaide. Hello to Sam Bashir in Sydney. We're not going to check in with you guys about the sound on account of it's 7:01 already. So down your way, it's 8:01 or something like that. So we'll get launched. So the spiritual laws is a fascinating thing because it came to me as a kind of a bit of an insight at one time. I spent most of my life teaching people how to get more, be more, have more, do more, and, you know, realise that to a large extent, whilst we're pretty successful teaching people how to do that, those people weren't necessarily very happy because they got more and they did more and they were being more and they had more and they owned more, but happiness remained about the same. And basically those same people started coming back to us and saying, there must be something else because I've succeeded on all these things, but, you know, there's still something not quite there. So we headed up to Queensland and got ourselves on the water, which was, you know, been a long-term goal. And so that was a trigger for me to be able to be up at 5 o'clock in the morning, get on the paddleboard and off I'd go. And I'd spend an hour and a half out there just finding solitude, but getting physically exercised, which was helping with the whole process of getting mentally clear and all that sort of stuff. So multi-pronged purpose and reason for that. But I found myself coming back from particularly the arduous ones, you know, where I'd paddle a bit further or gone for a bit longer or whatever. When I come back from those, I would know something that I didn't know before. And I, you know, it was kind of like a bit of a mystery that this stuff was dawning. And I started jotting it down and it coalesced into the book. And it was a very pleasant 7 or 8 months of finding within myself stuff that I did not know before I started looking for it. So that was a foundation of me saying, converting everything over and saying, okay, so I've got to teach people how to teach themselves. And you know, the rest is history. So that's where the book came from, and it's where the program came from. And I think it's amongst the things that I've done that I value the most. Of course, everybody sees it differently. So, you know, this kind of thing, you take from it what you will. I'm not going to teach this from the point of view of there's an absolute wisdom in it. I'm just going to kind of hopefully trigger some thoughts and some introspection in you, and you can take it from there. So essentially, I came across a bunch of paradoxes, and these are what I mean by a paradox is two apparent opposites, which could both be true at the same time. And I say apparent opposites because, you know, that's probably a giveaway that maybe they're not opposites. They're just different versions of the same thing. So, I came up with this whole idea of, when I was on the paddleboard, that I was out there and I was doing it, and I was very striving and I was very kind of searching and I was very busy, which we kind of talk about that with a negative bias or slant. But that allowed me to just be. And so I found this personal experience of not having to do anything, even though I was paddling the board pretty hard. And that kind of raised in my mind that what we do is we tend to bag the doing. We tend to say, you get too busy, we're all going too hard, all that sort of stuff. What I realized is that when doing is right, when we're doing something that is works for building our spirit, then we can be as busy as, and that probably it's true to say that mankind is happiest when he's in the pursuit of a worthy goal or a meaningful target or something that gives purpose and meaning. So what I realized was that we need to be good at doing and we need to be good at being. And that really what most people struggle with is they kind of say, oh, I'm doing too much doing, I'm too busy, so I have to slow it down. And that means I've got to get across to being, and I've kind of got to eliminate doing. And I think that eliminating doing is kind of the mistake that most people make. So it occurred to me that the thing about a paradox is that the truth for us is, how quickly can I get from one end of this arrow to the other? And that's why the double-ended arrow in describing this stuff was really the thing is, not can I do either end, but how quickly can I change from one end to the other, because I need to, because the circumstance of my life are changing or different or whatever. And so we all know that there's massive benefit in just being, you know, that you look at a three-year-old and, and I'm getting the daily experience with a three-year-old at the moment and, you know, she's just happy just to exist. But there's plenty of doing and there's plenty of activity and there's plenty of playing and having fun and all the rest of it. And if you say to a three-year-old, what do you want to do now? The short answer is play. If you say play, what, they look around and whatever, but they can play all day, but they can also just be. And so the playing is about being. And so I realized that if we get doing right, we're actually being. So that meant that really we've got to look at this concept from the point of view of how quickly we can get from doing to being and from being back to doing and not get stuck in the middle, which is where most people get stuck, is where they try and find balance and that kind of stuff. So we'll look at this in a bit more depth later, but I just want to establish these nine paradoxes and talk about the 10th one. But these were nine things that I could see were obviously paradoxical in their nature. Having written the book a couple of years back, that's probably 3 or 4 years ago now, what I've realized is much more of life is paradoxical than I've been able to identify when I came up with this stuff. But this is a really good start. This is a great place to kind of look at, okay, here's some basic concepts I've got to get right. Some things which, if I do them well, then I'm going to balance my life and I'm going to provide for myself enough of each of end of the paradox to live a really great life. So there's much more to it than what we're going to talk about tonight, but this is such a good grounding that it's worth doing. So the being versus doing thing simply boiled down to, we've got to be able to be at both ends and move from one end to the other really quickly. And then I went to an old chestnut, which had been around for ages in my mind. And I've been aware of this one for ages. And that was mostly because I was wanting to teach it to my kids and the people in my classes at the time. And that was that, we come up with this saying, you know, if you do enough of what you need, if you give yourself enough of what you need, you'll have everything that you want. But if you give yourself everything you want, you're never going to get what you need. And once again, that's expressed in terms of, you know, wants are negative and needs are positive. And they're even kind of written on this screen that you see in that kind of a way, where we talk about the wants as fun and possessions and chocolate and almost like they don't have the meaning that and the depth that the needs have, you know, nutrition, education, rest, exercise, those kind of things, you know. But really, I'm wanting to portray on the screen the kind of generalized teaching in our culture that says your wants are things that you need to be very careful about, and your needs, you need to be getting on with them. My experience is that these are equally as important, because if you do everything that you need, you're never going to get any wants happening until you're well into your old age. And therefore, you know, life without chocolate is not as much fun as life with chocolate or with possessions or those kind of things. And so there's this truism that if there's not enough of what you want in your life's not really worth living. So we kind of got to look at how we marry those two together. Once again, that comes down to speed across the middle rather than any other kind of version of what we're talking about. Now we'll come back to that as we talk about it. I really just want to paint a picture here. And of course, then we went on to the old strengths versus vulnerable. And once again, our culture teaches us that if we're vulnerable, then that, you know, that's kind of good. And if we're strong, then that can, if you overdo that, it's going to convert into hardness and being protective and defensive. And defensive is never good when you're trying to communicate with people that you love and all that sort of gear. So there's this bias about, you know, your strength is in your vulnerability. And really, you kind of got to be careful about that brittle outer strength that, you know, as young men, we're taught we need to have lots of. And as young women, we're taught would be good to have as well. So everybody gets toughened up and, you know, drink a glass of concrete and toughen up and face the facts of life and all those sort of things. What I've found is that there are times when we need to exhibit our strength. But there are times when being vulnerable is actually exhibiting our strength, because it takes an act of courage to do that. So once again, we have a cultural bias towards one end or the other, when in actual fact, we need both of these, like all the others, probably in equal portions, in equal doses, so to speak. So we've got to be careful about that. And once again, the trick is to not get stuck somewhere. And so what I say to most people, what you've got to do with these bunch of double-ended arrows is kind of put a dot somewhere that indicates which side of the middle you're on. And so if you're kind of, you know, biased towards your needs rather than your wants, then the dot would be on the lower part of the page. If you're biased towards your strength rather than your vulnerability, the dot would be further up on the page. So if you just kind of pick one side of the middle, and that's probably all you have to do. You could probably, you know, you could ask yourself, well, how far from the middle am I? Bit of a subjective thing, but it might help in terms of getting a bit of a look at the whole thing. So the reason I say that is if you're on one side of the middle, then the reality is you don't have a lot of ability to change. That dot that you put on the screen, wherever you're putting it between the two arrows, that dot more or less reveals to you your lack of flexibility, because this is okay, that's your preferred position. It's where you are most often. But if that's where you are most often, then you are inevitably on some occasions going to be in the wrong spot, and that we need to be able to move to wherever is the correct spot to be. Next one we look at is the whole concept of time standing still and time vanishing. This is something that's particularly poignant to me at the moment. You know, it's kind of like, you talk to any parent and I'll tell you about their kids grew up while they're not watching, that, you know, we can be so busy that we miss things, you know, events and times in our life, whole entire periods where our kids were growing up. So we tend to have a bit of a negative view of that. Time standing still, we talk about when we meditate and when we're connected within and how focused we can be and get into flow and all of those sort of things. So there's a bit of a bias in our culture to say that, you know, time vanishing, we do too much of that, and time standing still, we don't do enough of it. The reality is we need both of them, because if you don't understand that time will go up in smoke, then you'll waste it. And wasting time is kind of like the greatest sin from the point of view of, you know, there's the resource that you have the least of on the planet is time. Probably only second to your own personal grunt power and energy, so to speak. So I think that there are two things that are in extraordinarily short supply. One is time, and the other is your life force, so to speak. And you'll notice that some people can live a long time but have no life force. Other people can live a shorter life or a longer life, but they've got a lot of life force, a lot of energy, a lot of exuberance, a lot of power over life. You know, you can meet a sprightly, spunky, interested 95-year-old, or you can meet a dull 70-year-old or 50-year-old. I met school teachers who were dull 30-year-olds, so no age limits there. But really what I want to say is put yourself one side of the middle in terms of where you think you are biased towards being most of the time, because that's what's going to help us work through this material as we go through it. So this is another paradox. We need to be at both ends. The question is, how quickly can you move from one end to the other? How much ability you have to do that, or how stuck in the mud you tend to get, or how you pretty much stay the same and don't change. Then we go to the next paradox, which is I need to put me first. I need to take care of me so that I can help all the people that I want to help. But basically, I need to go and help all the people that I want to help. And all the time that I'm putting into me is time that I'm not putting into the people who I've made commitments to, and I've, you know, perhaps taken their faith or their promise or their money or whatever it is and said, I'm going to do something and I'm doing less of it because I'm looking after me kind of thing. So once again, paradoxical in nature. The whole put your oxygen mask on first is so that you can help other people get theirs on, because if you don't get yours on quickly, you're going to be unconscious and therefore you're not helping anyone, especially yourself, let alone others. But then, you know, to serve, it's kind of like we need to understand that to be really of service, I need to understand what you need. I need to kind of study that and work with that enough to know how I can best be of service and what works for you rather than what I want for you. So therefore we have this expression, my wish for you is your wish for you. So that's the whole me first and servicing. Many people feel guilty about putting themselves first because they're taught to do that. They've been shamed around taking care of themselves. When you think about it, taking care of yourself is kind of like basically just sensible. Because, you know, the Buddhists have got a saying, you cannot serve from an empty cup. So if you're not looking after yourself, then you are less useful to the rest of the planet. So that's that one. And once again, you just give yourself a dot between the arrowhead somewhere or other, depending on which way you're biased. Because whatever the bias is, that's where you're kind of stuck. And that will indicate to you where the work needs to be done in terms of gaining back the flexibility that allows you to be whoever you need to be, whenever you need to be that person, so that you can do whatever it is that's going to make your life work really well. Thanks, honey. So, a bit of water there. Okay, so then we went to the next one, which was the whole idea of scarcity and abundance. And there's definitely a teaching in this, particularly around the personal development field. So one of the things that, you know, when I first got in the personal development field, there was this whole kind of, you know, if you've got a scarcity mentality, you've got to get rid of that. And it's true that if you do have a scarcity mentality, it does make you desperate and, you know, a bit cheap and nasty and mean and grasping and those kind of things. And lacking faith that the world will actually deliver, or the universe or God or however you want to put that. And there's also equally kind of bent idea about abundance, is that if you've just got an abundance mentality that, you know, everything you want will come to you. I think both of these are kind of, you know, been dealt a serious blow by the Loopy Brigade. What I mean by abundance and scarcity is that with scarcity, what we need to understand is we're not here forever. That, you know, time is running out, that your body will only last so long, that we need to treasure the moments that we tend to not to. We kind of, you know, I'll get to that later kind of thing, tends to be used for family time and connection with the loved ones and that sort of stuff. And yet at the same time, we need to understand that there is plenty to go around, that we do have plenty of time and we do have plenty of money and we do have plenty of resources, and you know, we're wealthy in friendships and wealthy in care and concern and wealthy in love and all those sort of things. And that we can actually let go of things, that we don't have to hang on to something. Sometimes hanging on to something is because I have a scarcity mentality, pretending that I'm abundant. So I might be surrounded by abundance. This happened to my mum and dad. They retired with significant amount of money. So they were literally technically abundant, but the scarcity mentality simply meant that they couldn't spend it. They ended up blowing it. They ended up managing to make it all disappear, or most of it. And that was really because they brought a scarcity mentality into an abundant set of circumstances. So a bit tragic. You know, you might have heard me say my dad drove a car that he hated for 11 years. And every time I said to him, you know, why don't you sell it? He'd go, oh, I just put new tyres on it, or whatever it was. And so, you know, he just couldn't let it go for fear of waste or loss or those kind of things. And I see that a lot in my work, you know, people who need to let something go, but they don't because they might realize a loss, or they might realize, you know, that it'll crystallize something that's gone. You know, like, you know, many people will not act on a divorce when they need to, because divorce is a very final kind of a word, very final kind of a verdict. You know, there's a lot of people want to stay away from that because they're afraid of it actually turning into what it really is already, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Once again, put a dot on the double-ended arrow to indicate where your normal position is. I was going to say your preferred position, but what I mean is your more normal position, because it may not be preferred position at all. Next paradox we looked at was the idea of detachment versus desire. This is something you'll be very familiar with if you've seen the Yerkes-Dodson performance curve, where we graph stress against performance. And what we see is that for many people, they can rise to an occasion when there is more stress or a bit of tension, that their performance actually goes up. They're actually better at what they do. But if that stress continues to escalate, then the performance deteriorates. And so we look at how do we manage to stay in the zone, so to speak, the high performance zone. And it boils down to a combination of the ability to really, really want something, but also to let it go. And that's, you know, I really, really want a nice car, but I also need to understand it's just a collection of bolts. And, you know, when I'm finished with it, we're going to trade it in or sell it or move it on or give it away or whatever. And we get the next collection of bolts. And, you know, many people use their car as a way of feeling good about themselves, when in actual fact, it's just an object. And, you know, the car takes on a lot more significance than it deserves because it's not an object anymore. And as soon as it's not an object, then we have an emotional relationship with it, and the emotional relationship is kind of leaves a lot to be desired. So we're talking about desire being really great because it gets us to want to achieve things and do things and aim at goals and targets and be better than we were and those kind of things. And we look at detachment from the point of view of, you know, the real you, the spirit in you, doesn't really have a relationship with money or possessions or, you know, most of the things that our culture values. So have a look at that and go, okay, where am I strong? If I'm going to put a dot either side of the middle, which side would I put it on? My observation is that our culture is kind of like almost universally driven by desire. The advertisers certainly know that. So most advertising is done with, you know, by triggering strong emotions, because if we can trigger a strong emotion, we can get people to spend money on stuff that they don't want or don't need or could wait until later, or they're going to buy by paying over the odds or whatever it is. So most well-written sales copy goes into desire and stays right away from detachment. So, you know, it's not a boat, it's a lifestyle accessory. In fact, I heard a marketing guy from Porsche in Germany a few years back describing the fact that Porsche no longer makes motor cars. They make lifestyle accessories, and these lifestyle accessories take various forms. So they make briefcases, and they make motor cars and shoes and all sorts of cool stuff that people who are Porsche-philes want to have, because they're going to say it's got superior design. But basically it's about how they feel about themselves when they in the presence of those kind of things. So when we can detach from that, we can see that it's a briefcase is just a briefcase, that a Porsche watch, so to speak, a wristwatch, is, well, it's just a watch. So it tells the time. That's what it does. Nowadays, a watch will do more than tell the time, but you get the general idea. So pick a spot either side of the middle for that one. And then we're going to go to what I call one of the great fears for mankind, and that's the fear of the unknown. So most people struggle with this idea that there is mystery in our life, and a lot of that mystery is not going to be solved until we end our life, you know, kind of whether there's really a God or not. It's going to be sorted out after you can't change your mind, which, you know, pretty funny when you think about it. So I see one of the biggest fears that mankind experiences and shows up in my work is the fear of the unknown. one of the things we do about that is we create predictions around it, because predictions create certainty or security or a sense of we know what's going to happen, so we can prepare for that. I'm talking about these in terms of the bias that our culture teaches us. So our culture teaches us that the unknown is scary, and that therefore, you know, what is predictable allows us to be secure and feel okay, that kind of stuff. But the reality is both ends of this paradox are great places to be. Same with all of them. It's when you admit that you don't know what's happening next, that you don't know about God, the universe, life and all, and the meaning of it, all that sort of stuff, that you can really embrace the mystery of life and the magical components of it. But without predictions, we can't work out what we should do next, because, you know, I was talking to a client earlier this week. He's 35 or 36 years old and wants to buy a house. And the house, you know, it's a funny thing. To him, the price is, you know, unbelievably stratospheric, but it's only 700 grand. And, you know, that's one of those things where a small amount is a large amount, depending on the position you're looking from. And I said to him, how are you making this decision about buying or not buying? He said, I'm reading about what's going to happen in the world economy, or what could happen in the world's economy in the next year or two. And I'm petrified. And I said to him, you know, if there was a prediction, would you be okay? He said, yeah, if someone could come out with a definitive answer about what's going to happen to the world economy, I wouldn't even care which way they were saying it was going to go, as long as I could believe that. He said, the trouble is, for every argument says the world economy is going to crash, there's another one that says that it's actually going to peak, and the guy's in confusion and, you know, terrorizing himself and in need of something certain. And I said to him, you know, the only thing that's certain are your feelings. And if you know that you want to get into the property market, and you want your own place to call your own, and you want to have a go at the do-it-yourself thing, then that's very predictable. And you can go right ahead, and you know, you won't lose any money on that house if you don't sell it. So maybe there will be a period of 5 years or whatever where the house is worth less than the mortgage on it. But, you know, as long as you're prepared to stay in the job you're in and do the things that you do and earn the money that you earn, then you can just kind of, you can still enjoy a very beautiful existence in your home that's worth less than you paid for it, or less than the mortgage, and just hang on long enough to ride that out. And, you know, hopefully that time will come. So that's all cool from the point of view of how we can look at it. And he said something very revealing to me. He said, I just wish I could have a different relationship with money. And he was really being pushed around by his inability to loosen up around money. And when we talked about his finances, he was talking about the difficulty of buying this place, but what it would do is that after he's paid his deposit and mortgage lender's insurance and a bunch of others, he would only have 25,000 left in the bank. And I know that most 35-year-olds don't even have 35,000 left in the bank. And he was panicking about that's all he's got left. So, you know, a distorted relationship with money simply means that, you know, it's distorting everything else as well. So that's this kind of unknowns and predictions thing. We need to be able to predict how things are going to go so that we can say to ourselves, well, if I put time and effort into going to the gym or changing my diet or whatever, the chances are that my body's going to lose weight or change shape or be different or get fitter or be able to run upstairs better or whatever it is. So we need predictions from the point of view of, you know, what are the likely results of putting my effort in? We also need to know that the unknown simply means you might get there early, you might get there late, you may never get there. You might get to some other place that's entirely better. You know, you might go to the gym, not lose any weight, but meet the person that you spend the rest of your life with. So was going to the gym a good thing or a bad thing? Well, if you understand mystery and magic, then you'll understand that we can't know. We can't know everything, and that we ought to actually come to terms with that. That would be a very cool thing for us to do. So once again, put yourself on either side of the middle. For many of you, you're going to be on the predictions end, but that's not necessarily true. So just have a look at that. Give yourself an indicator, remembering that this is really just telling you where you need to do the personal work on yourself. And finally, that brings us to the concept of separation and unity. And what I mean by that is that you know, when we're separated, when you'll hear a lot of negative talk about separation, about, you know, nowadays with smartphones, we can isolate a lot and people are more and more living by themselves and not interacting on the bus or the train or other community events, and how, you know, we're losing something out of our culture out of that. Therefore, separation is a bad thing and that unity is a good thing and we ought to be more of, you know, we ought to play as a team and be more together and all that sort of stuff. So there's a bit of a kind of a cultural bias towards unity as a better thing. If I talk to you separately about it, what I'm going to suggest to you is that if you look at separation positively, that's where you can be introspective and enjoy solitude and understand yourself better and actually understand that I'm stuck inside this body that is mine, but at the unity end, we are all one, and that I can connect with this oneness by bringing this singular that is me into a place where I could experience harmony and peace. So that's a good example of how these things can both be true at the same time. So there, once again, give yourself a, you know, put a dot on the double-ended arrow. Which side of the middle do you tend to be most often? The purpose for that, putting that dot, is so that you can look at that and go, is that good for me? Is that serve me? How well does that work for me? Or otherwise, so that you can work on your own personal development plan from that perspective. That's pretty much what I first came up with. And then I realized, you know, that what happens is that in the center of us, right in the middle of all of our experiences, is our soul or our spirit or our essence or our core or what some people call the observer. This soul, for want of a better word, is always neutral, is always balanced, is continuously observing and is always at peace. What that means is if you wanted to move from one end to the other, you would not experience any slowdown in this middle bit. That what would happen is that you would speed through this central area here because your soul or your essence has no substance. And therefore you can be at full speed as you travel from one end to the other. And that would be very cool if it wasn't for some other things that are kind of like on the inside of us as well. So part of what makes you up is your self-image. So most of us have a self-image and it does a bloody good job of covering up our inner selves, our real you. And if you've ever seen me do the self-image diagram with the star and the block and the crescent, then you'll notice that self-image kind of blocks us understanding our pure, innocent, perfect selves. And so the self-image by definition is not real. And the consequence of that simply mean that what happens is that the self-image is limited. The soul or the essence is unlimited. Because the self-image is limited, then when we're trying to move through this area, the grey area, then we experience this feeling of kind of like trying to run in mud, that we have limitations. And these limitations are the things that stop us from moving from one end to the other, or changing our mind, or changing our mindset, or understanding something differently, or coming to a different conclusion, or seeing something a different way. And the more solid self-image, the more set in concrete then we tend to be, and the less capable we are of operating with the paradoxes, because these paradoxes require speed across the middle. So self-image is something that we need to work on. But of course, it's not the only thing. Surrounding the self-image is our personality or our ego or the barrier that we use to keep people at a distance. And the reason that we do that is that we feel like we're much more acceptable if we project something without limitations that we perceive in our self-image. And so my personality is kind of like, you know, what I project in terms of, I think if I act this way, people will like me better. And I'm sure you've met somebody who's, you know, the life of the party, and somebody who's a wallflower, and somebody who's whatever, and every personality type, whether it's a perfectionist or a hero or a princess or a peacemaker or a martyr or whatever, all those personality types are really just defense mechanisms that stop people from manipulating us, or we think they stop people from manipulating us. So those things are much more set in concrete than a self-image, much more difficult to make progress through. And of course, the reason we talk about everybody else having an opinion about you and what you do is because that's what the personalities do, is trying to repel them. So if you look at these circles, these concentric circles in the middle there, you'll see that getting from one end of a paradox to the other isn't too hard if you're in the middle, but it's really difficult to get from one end to the middle. simply because you've got to penetrate three layers before the going gets easy. And so for most of us, real progress comes down to handling the rest of the world, our personality and our self-image. So on Saturday, we went to talk about that. And essentially, I gave you something that many of you would be familiar with. This is what we call the star block and crescent diagram. And the star is the real you. You know, as we say, 10 out of 10, child of God, the real inner core essence, the perfection of you. The self-image is a part that is a view of yourself that you have deliberately formed, not deliberately, but consequentially formed as a consequence of your experience in life. So your self-image is that you are in somehow or some way limited, that you're too tall or too short or too fat or too skinny or you know, four eyes, freckle face, whatever it is. And so there's something wrong with us. And when we see our limitations, then we put into place this act or this barrier or this facade that is meant to impress people or to flatter them or to keep the real us hidden because we feel like we'll be judged. And so the whole idea here is that what happens is that the rest of the world's and its plans for us hits in on that purple crescent and hopefully bounces off. So, you know, there's the world saying, you know, you really ought to do this and you should never do that. And why do you always, and you're lazy and all those sort of things. We bounce all of that stuff off and we think that we're going to be okay. But essentially there's really an eternal struggle going on. And it really boils down to this. If you look at it on one side, it's I have to have goals. Apparently the more of them and the clearer they are, the better. But then we kind of struggle with, well, hang on, am I just a goal-achieving mechanism that's put here to pay off the house? And, you know, does anybody really care about that aside from Westpac, et cetera? Or, you know, I'm supposed to be disciplined and never eat chocolate, but isn't life without chocolate a bit pointless? And this goes on, and we talked a little bit about these. They're not paradoxes, they're just conflicts. They're this internal struggle about, you know, I really want stuff, but do I really need it? You know, why can't I stop myself doing the things that are bad for me? But I love doing the things that are bad for me, etc. Some things I can make happen easily just by thinking about them, etc. But other things elude me. It goes on and on and on. And we start thinking that the solution is balance, that what I need to do is that I need to kind of find this balance between the right amount of chocolate and the wrong amount of chocolate, or too much or too little. And that never really works. And the reason it doesn't work is the amount of chocolate I need today is different. Like even if I got the amount of chocolate right for today, it's not the right, that amount is not correct for tomorrow. And so, you know, it's very difficult to kind of say what's going to make it work tomorrow when I'm looking backwards. So balance doesn't really work. And yet many people struggle with it. So that's, you know, we're kind of talking about building a strong or healthy self-esteem by finding balance. But it's never really going to happen. The reason it's not going to happen is that we've got a mental scoreboard going on. And what we tend to do is, without too much awareness on it, we kind of keep this, I say mental mental scoreboard from the point of view of we never write this stuff down, and we tend to forget about it. It's not actually, it doesn't exist in our conscious. It exists in our subconscious. And so on the good side of it, you know, as we say things about ourselves, we have to admit, you know, like, okay, so once upon a time, I actually won a foot race, you know, or, you know, I've been really good to my children, or I'm generous, or, you know, blah, 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 whatever. Well, there's another side to the ledger, and that's all the things that I've messed up or that I'm not good at or whatever it is. And, you know, like, you know, I wasn't there for Pete, my friend, when he needed me, and I, you know, I ate too much chocolate, and, you know, then there was that argument. Oh, then there was an investment that I lost all the money in, and, you know, I don't know if my boss likes me at all. I sleep in too much, blah, 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 blah. And the only thing for you to notice is that the bad list is longer than the good list. And I've just described a typical human being kind of Australian type person, because really that's pretty much how it goes in terms of, don't worry about what's on the list. Just have a look at the size of one list compared to the other. And then look at what we do with them. And so what we do with the list of good stuff is we start to discount it. And I was, you know, I was sharing on Saturday that, you know, I had this experience when I was 14 or 15 where I actually came top in the maths test. And it was only the weekly test, but nevertheless, once, you know, I had that victory. And the victory lasted for about 10 minutes until I told myself, the girl who comes top of maths, she's away that day. And so that victory didn't really count. Over a period of time, and I could do this within 10 minutes, over a period of time, the things that we're good at start to not count anymore. And so the reason behind that, we'll look at that in a second. When you think about it, what we're really doing is we're undermining these things. So this is the thing I said, well, let's look at that in a second. We undermine the list of things that should lead to positive self-esteem. In other words, this is how we build poor self-esteem, is that the good things we do, we discount them. Of course, while we're discounting them, we pick on some things over there on the bad side and we start to reinforce them. So we keep telling ourselves that we're lazy or that we did something bad or that we, you know, we sleep in too much or had that affair or blah, 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 whatever it is. And that goes on and on and on. And so what we're doing is we're reinforcing stuff that we really ought to be letting go. And so simple logic tells you, you know, the solution is actually just to reverse that. That what we need to be doing is reinforcing that good stuff. So I talked about a victory book and how having a victory book would be really good. And those of you got young kids, basically what you want to do is sit on the edge of your bed before you go to sleep and just write in your, in a simple exercise book, two or three things that you did good today. You know, you rang someone you didn't want to ring and had an ugly conversation or whatever, so that that forces you to reinforce it and that we undermine or let go of the stuff on the bad side that, you know, we actually learn how to get over it and move on and understand, you know, that it was no more than a mistake. And as long as we learned from it and got something out of it, then everything's going to be cool. If we can do that, then we can dramatically build a positive self-esteem, because the good, if you think the screen hasn't changed, it's the good has got bolded now. So we can actually deliberately build healthy self-esteem. And I'm going to suggest to you that every ounce of energy that you put into building self-esteem is going to pay enormous, enormous dividends for the rest of your life. So this is not like something you can do and sort of hope that you just feel better. This is something that will change everything about the way that you live your life. Your ability to say no to people, your ability to deliver on time, how much integrity you live with, all of these things relate to your sense of self-esteem and how much effort you put into deliberately building that up so that it's better this year than it was last year. If we keep moving forward, let's have a look at it from the following point of view. If we grab one of the oldest paradoxes, or not so much the oldest, but one that I've been talking about the longest, I think I remember talking about this one first coming to light as something that I wanted to teach my students 15 to 20 years ago. And so basically I was teaching it from the point of view of, if you give yourself enough of what you need, you'll have everything that you want. But if you give yourself enough of what you want, you're never going to have whatever you need. That's all pretty obvious when you look at it. If you give yourself a ranking, put a dot somewhere along the length of the arrow, which you would have done earlier in this seminar when we were talking, and then look at the inner you in the middle, what you'll find is that you can not have to deal with that. You can actually get this right by giving yourself enough of what you want and enough of what you need. So that means that we will get through this inner part pretty easy, because there's no resistance there. We're just going to struggle in the conflict and the self-image area because of, you know, the ego gets in the way and the internal battle struggles up. So really, when you think about it, the range of movement is limited. I've included the inner you and half of the self-image, because half the time in self-esteem we let ourselves off and we let ourselves go. But the reality is a bit more difficult to deal with there. But if you look at being a bit generous, I'm saying sometimes your personality works for you in terms of delivering the results that you want, sometimes it doesn't. So giving you half of the personality, what that means is the range that you move in is probably somewhere like that. So I'm going to say the average of that oval is in the middle of it, and that's where I tend to hang out. This is not going to be good for me because I get stuck there. That point where the average is, or the point where the range is, that's actually the problem. What we want is that. What we want is for our spirit to grow, for our spirit to become so enormous it swallows up self-esteem, it swallows up personality, and we get driven from our spirit. And this is what I mean when I say, who wants to live a more spiritual life? And most people put their hands up and go, yeah, that's me. And I'm saying, okay, the way you do that is you contact your inner spirit more often. You can't build your inner spirit. It's gigantic. It's bigger than you can imagine. But what you can do is you can spend more time with it. You can spend more, you can be more connected to it. You can live more spiritually by going within. And that was a big lesson for me about the paradoxes, is that all I had to do to live more spiritually was get up and spend time by myself. And the more time I spent on myself in solitude, paddling that bloody board and trying to do a good job of that, the more mindful I became, and the more mindful I became, and that was about paddling the board hard, then the more wisdom just seemed to dawn on me, the more my personality and ego dropped out of the way. I'm not saying it's gone. I'm just saying it has less control. And my spirit, I feel my spirit more. I don't think my spirit's any bigger than it was, but I feel it more. I feel more connected to the real me than at any other time in my life. And of course, what we want to do is we want that to grow like crazy. And if it grows like crazy, then that's why the next ring. And really, if you had the inner you expanded right out to where the dotted line is, you could be both at the wants end and the needs end, both at the same time. And that, my friends, would be magic. And that's your assignment, is to be at the wants end and the needs end, both at the same time. In other words, the time for you to get from one end to the other, zero, because you can actually connect from one to the other in a millisecond. That's the cool thing. That's the really beautiful thing to do. So we spend a long time looking at, okay, so what do these things look like when we're at either end? And I'm not going to really spend a lot of time with you tonight on that, because we don't have the time to do it. There are wonderful benefits of being at the needs end, and there are wonderful benefits of being at the wants end. What we want to do is stay out of the middle, what I named the quagmire, but you could call it the swamp or whatever. So how do you know when you're not at the wants end or at the needs end? You'll be experiencing the stuff that's in the middle here. In this case, judgment, possessiveness, tantrums, ego, the desire for status, all those kind of things. So really what I'm saying here is that the gray area is your kind of warning signal. If you want to live a better life and you're finding yourself being overindulgent or comparing yourself to others or throwing tantrums, then you've lost the grip on either end. And you've got to get to one end or the other as quickly as you can, so that you can start looking to get to the other end by jumping across, by expanding your inner spirit and skipping across the swamp. Because we don't get stuck in that swamp. You can see that possessiveness is just going to suck you in and keep you glued in there like quicksand. So we then started to make the comparison. If you look at detachment and desire, then the truth is you have to really, really want the result. You know, your goals and your targets, they've got to be important to you. But if you need them, then they own you. You know, if you need the car to make you feel good, then the car owns you. That's a problem there. So give yourself a ranking between one end and in the other. Put the dot there somewhere and understand that for many years we've talked about the zone. This is desire and detachment, which is actually, you'll see this show up in terms of this is the paradox, is that I have to want it and not want it. And if I can get that right, then I can be in my high-performance zone. If you look at what desire delivers for us, it allows us to work at things. We get focused and we get action and we get planning and goal-setting happening. And the detachment thing means that we can practice forgiveness and we can maintain a helicopter view of things, and that we see mystery and wonder in the world because we can see things turning up just magically, which is absolutely beautiful when you think about it. You would be happy at either end, except you'd be missing the other end. And that's why we say, get a foot in both camps and live in both places at once. But you got to step over the quagmire. And you'll know that you're in the quagmire if you can't forgive. If you're self-centered, which is a difficult thing for people to know when they are. But if you're seeing things in terms of black and white, right and wrong, all of those kind of things, you'll get needy, then you'll know that you're stuck in the middle and the signals are there for you to get out of there, like buy a rocket and get going. We then went to being and doing and the paradox there. And so give yourself a, you know, you'll have done this already, put a dot somewhere between the two arrows. We say the thing to hold on to is you're a human being, not a human doing. But there are benefits of being at both ends. And so what we get taught is that, you know, we will get approval if we achieve more. We never ask ourselves, would that be a good thing? We just assume more of everything is better. You know, what's better than one chocolate is two chocolates, et cetera, et cetera. Our assumption about overcoming the hurdles in life is that, you know, we race along, we bump into a hurdle, we hardly saw it. We go on our backside. So this is my diagram for us going on our backside. we stand ourselves up and dust ourselves off and say, I'll just have another go at this. And when I get over it, this time it's going to be easy street on the other side of the thing. But we haven't noticed that life comes along with a bulldozer and backfills it. And that next time we get over it, we won't get over it. We'll get over it and we'll trip over because we're going to fall flat in our face because we expected to go back to easy street when, in fact, we're now going to have to run along at a higher level. And it is true that life expects more of you. The more you achieve, the more you accomplish, the more, the bigger, the next challenge is it's going to be bigger. And so we go on our backsides again. We'll get up and we get going again, thinking that it's easy street again, but we run into another one. And what we don't realize is that the teaching program that is life is going to ask you to continue to perform at a higher and higher level. And so we've got to be really careful about our being and doing. So as far as being is concerned, we need to be able to be still enough to find connection and to practice mindfulness and to be in the whole joy, peace and love thing. And, you know, meditation is going to be a beautiful addition to that kind of thing. But there's magic in doing, you know. You can't sit meditating on a hill all day if you've been brought up in Western cultures because there's too much challenge available. There are too many great things for you to explore and to do and to learn and to share and to plan, to do and be all over and just to enjoy making happen. So, you know, human beings are turned on by challenge. Well, challenge comes from doing, not from being. So once again, you'll see magical benefits at either end of the paradox here. What we've got to do is avoid the quagmire in the middle. What's that going to look like? Well, basically ownership, possessiveness, the rat race, comparisons and judgment and busyness showing up and all those sort of things. So we've got to watch for those. Next one we looked at was strength versus vulnerability. Once again, what you can do is give yourself a ranking. Of course, you've already done that. So let's go straight to what you get. Well, essentially, at one end of strength is kind of all these magical things where we can be passionate and we can exhibit our power and bring our power to the things that we want to do and, you know, display our resilience and our integrity and our persistence and those kind of things. But vulnerability means that we're open and that we're available and that we can demonstrate compassion and we can be authentic with people and we can influence things and get connected to the whole lot. Magical place to be. Once again, two magical places to be. You just don't want to get stuck in the middle. What does it look like? Well, basically conflict or brutality, incongruence, you know, using force to get what we want, feeling protective of what we got, those kind of things. You know, they're all ugly things when you think about them. You can be strong and brittle. So, you know, this kind of, that can be hard. So watch out for that kind of stuff. That's where the middle is. I recommended Brené Brown's book. That's the book, Daring Greatly. She's written a couple of others. And I think I haven't read the others, but I hear them highly recommended. If you want a summary, then she's done a TED Talk. That TED Talk's kind of getting on now. It's like 8 years old, 9 years old, really, but, you know, still full, packed full of power, packed full of insight, a beautiful presentation. It really, really makes sense. You probably would benefit from watching that once a year. So if you need to understand vulnerability more, then she does a really great job of it, much better than I could do. So we move on to predictions versus the unknown. It's the one that throws people a lot. You're giving yourself a ranking either side of the middle. So if we go to, okay, what do you get at each end? Once again, we see this magical, beautiful thing that comes from embracing the idea we've got no idea what's going on, because that's where wonder comes from and mystery and magic, and it's where joy and peace can be made and we can connect with each other and we can and be open, and it's just magical. But predictions allow us to have hope and to set goals and to look at what kind of contribution we want to make or act authentically and develop some sense of security about ourselves and express our individuality in whatever form that shows up. These things, once again, you look at both these lists, you go, man, how good it would be to be at either end. So either end is great, but how quickly can you be moving from one to the other instantly? The quagmire, how will you know you're there? Well, once again, you'll see our old friend ego showing up, but manipulation. You'll be afraid, experiencing fear, the need for getting security via ownership and sticking with rigid and inflexible systems, those kind of things. That's what the quagmire looks like in that one. Which takes us to the next paradox, which is a whole idea of separation versus unity. like I said, you'll have given yourself a score already by putting a dot somewhere either side of the middle. What's on offer from Unity? Pretty much everything. This is where we get the full enchilada. So you're looking at, you know, joy, peace, love, mystery, meditation, mindfulness, connection. Like, there's so much magic at that thing. You kind of think, you know, holy moly, who would ever want to leave there? But when you think about, you know, being you, then there's some magic here, you know, being able to create something that's truly an expression of your uniqueness and having a personality that's just yours and enjoying me time. You know, there's so much benefit there that obviously it's a blend of these things that works for us. You'll know that you're struggling if you get stuck in the middle and you're experiencing scarcity and conflict and failure has too much meaning for you and you're feeling not good enough or unconnected and experiencing conflict, those kind of things. You can see that conflict is kind of like the really polar opposite of either end of this paradox. So that's a big red warning sign there. If we go to time vanishing and time standing still, you're giving yourself a ranking on that. If we look at, okay, what's on offer? Then at the eternity end, in other words, you are eternal, or at least your spirit is. Then once again, there's the big ones, joy, peace, and love, but mystery and mindfulness and the sense that time is endless and that we can be present and in the moment things can stand still and that, you know, 3 moments can be like 4 weeks kind of thing. If you understand time vanishing, you understand your own mortality and you can age gracefully rather than in an ugly way. You can get into mentoring and passing on your skills and growing from the inside and understanding that there are golden moments and you should snatch them and grab them, perhaps not in a snatching and grabbing kind of a way. You'll know that you're struggling if, once again, you're experiencing ego or unconsciousness or busyness or you just miss something happening because, you know, it was right there in front of you. But, you know, classically speaking, the kids grew up while I was not watching. If you're involved in accumulation and feeling like there's a rat race going on and you're just a bit of a number, then that's a quagmire, a very ugly place to be, and we'd want to get out of there as quick as we could. Which leaves us with abundance and scarcity. If you look at that one, then essentially, if you give yourself a ranking on that, which we did earlier in this exercise, and we start to look at what's on offer from the abundance end, then this is just too good to be true. It's not too good to be true. It's actually the reality of our experience. But when you look at that list and realize, you know, there they are again, joy, peace, and love, hanging in there. But we can fully experience freedom and faith in our ability to make things happen and faith in the world being a great place. And we can dematerialize things or disconnect from material things. But at the same time, understand that we should turn up and be present because we don't have forever. And that we could be really careful and we could see sacredness in things that we do and wonder and feel a connection and, once again, mystery. You know, mystery is kind of part of the real magic in life. Once again, 2 ends where you'd want to be at both ends as much as you could, and I'd recommend you get to both ends as much as you could and that you stay out of this joint where you'll know that you're in a quagmire if you're feeling that possessiveness stuff turn up or impulsiveness that's difficult to describe or feelings of being lost or confused or those kind of things, which takes us to the me first versus service routine there. Give yourself a ranking on that. And then we go and have a look at what's on offer and what are the things that we can benefit from there. If you look at me first, there's a whole pile of stuff about taking the long-term view here that we need to reinvigorate ourselves and refresh and revitalize just so that we can do better down at the service end. But at the service end, that's where you get really resourceful and you understand your own humility and you become humble and you practice faith and you feel blessed in life. And, you know, there's hardly a person who does an act of service who doesn't feel blessed by the person they were able to serve. This is a staggering concept that we feel like we've been blessed by the person who let us serve them. Of course, you'll know you're not in either delightful end if you're feeling some of the big five, shame and guilt and resentment and confusion and instability, uncertainty, self-doubt, arrogance, those kind of things. You know, these are devastating when you come across them. I think probably the most damaging is confusion because it keeps us stuck there in the middle. So So those are the paradoxes that we looked at, and I'm talking about the benefits of both ends and how to stay out of the middle. We then went on to talk about the personal success routine and how much value it delivers. And you know what? It doesn't matter who I talk to, whether it's my high-end clients, our fast-track people, elite people, success club, doesn't matter what it is. Essentially, what I hear over and over again is people saying to me, if I could just get my personal success routine in order, everything would work out. Everything else would work out. And I agree with them. But I'm not going to sit here and talk to you about it when I've talked so much about it. I would refer you to the personal success routine sessions that we have done. Go and check them out, because there's a heap of information, and I'm sure looking at it again will deliver more value to you. You'll see something you didn't see before, and it might be the breakthrough. We then went on to consider another paradox, and that particular paradox is the whole idea that whilst I am smaller than a grain of sand on the beach in terms of the universe, and that I am myself, and that I'm inside my own head and my own body, and that I'm single, and that I'm individual, and that I'm a one, so singular, I'm also connected to everybody and everything, and I am all possibilities, and everything is possible at once. So this is a bigger one to grab a hold of. And maybe the way to describe it is to say, you know, there's probably, if there's 7 billion people on the planet, there's probably a billion of them who are trying to do something significant in the world, whether that's clean the oceans or clean the air or, you know, just be a good neighbor or whatever it is, they're trying to do something significant in the world. So the chance of you being the one who, you know, the one who creates that magnificent difference in the rest of the world are next to zero. However, you could actually be the one. You know, it's like what lottery winners say. You know, your chance of winning the lottery are next to zero. But if you don't buy a ticket, then they're worse than that. So you could actually be the one who wins the lottery or comes up with the other end. So we have to embrace that concept. And when you think about it, understanding that I am unique allows me to say I exist and I'm a blank canvas and I can paint my life any way that I want and there's nothing to lose. That I can understand my mortality and understand I get one shot at life and I ought to have a go rather than I play conservative and not really try. So that's the benefits at that end. When I understand I'm infinite and that I can tap into any kind of wisdom or understanding or whatever it is, then I can create and I can be possible. I can actually be limitless, because if you can find out whatever you need to know, then, perhaps you can be immortal. What you produce, what you do, what you stand for, what you believe in, what you do with your life could go on forever. How do you know you're stuck in the middle? Well, basically, if you're experiencing anything like feeling like a passenger, that life is passing you by, that you're a bit lost or lonely, or that you're dependent on other things going on around you, or frustration, then the reality is that you're stuck in the middle and you've got to get to one end or the other as quickly as possible so that you can get one foot into that camp and then one foot into the other, and straddle that middle is probably the best way to describe this. I then went on to say, okay, so success is paradoxical because, our desire is, our desire to be successful is driven by our dreams and our hopes and our aspirations. But it's driven by us thinking that we'll be happier, that we'll be able to enjoy what comes to us as a consequence of our efforts, that we'll be able to contribute to our community, there'll be less drama and all those sort of things. And those things are worthy goals. And let's face it, you know, being successful beats failure just like hands down. There's no competition there. But rarely does success deliver what it promised it was going to deliver, because success whispers in your ear, when we get there, we'll be happy. Everything will be great. Everything will be smooth, fantastic, whatever. Rarely does that actually happen, because what happens is that success multiplies what you've already got. And if you've got a relationship that is struggling and you end up with more success, then that relationship will struggle more because there's more pressure on it. So the terrible truth about being more successful is that the more successful you are, then the more you are and the more things get amplified. And so, you know, arguments turn into divorces, et cetera, et cetera. So the challenge is to understand that becoming successful isn't really the thing. It's the challenge is to become the best version of you. And I'm saying yes, especially when you're struggling, because what that's going to do, that's going to deliver satisfaction, fulfillment, inner peace, happiness, the full enchilada. Therefore, what we can say is paradoxically, you have to want to be successful, but at the same time, you'll value who you become in the process more than what you got from the process. And if you understand that, you understand heaps of really, really big stuff. We have published a bunch of worksheets for this program. So what you can do is from the website, you can download that. Let me just drink a water. Sorry about that. So I would recommend that you work your way through these worksheets. You'll see that the worksheets are bigger. There's more of them than we've ever done before, because this is such a big subject. We've also done the same thing with evaluation sheets. So you can download those from the member site and work your way through those. I'd highly recommend those. Once again, you'll see there's two instead of the usual one, because there's a lot of material to cover. That just gives you plenty to be going on with. In terms of what's next, then we've got our session tonight, which is shortly going to end. But then our next workshop is Saturday, the 18th of January, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Sydney time. I'm going to recommend that you get to that. We've got something really special for you. So if you're on holidays and you wanted to head up to Queensland, then I'm going to suggest that number 3 Harrigan's Lane, Jacobsville, would be a really good place for you to spend the 18th of January. But of course, if you want to join us, then you'll need to let us know. What's happening with these workshops is that they are filling up. So we're pretty excited to announce that there's only 12 seats in the room. And that's why you need to let us know if you want to come. But we had our highest turnout last Saturday. I think there was 10 or 11 people in the room. So word's getting out that it's worth being there live. So love to have you with us, but you'll need to let us know if that's the case, if you want to do that. And like I said, we've got something special coming up for you then. Things for you to remember is if you get to that Facebook group and then post about progress, those kind of things, then that's really going to make it work for everybody, because this is a place that I can most easily get on there. You can support each other, but I can get in and do some coaching. I'm open to any questions you want to ask, because the more questions you ask, the better the whole thing goes. And if they're big questions or significant questions, then that's fantastic, because what we can do is we can make video answers to those questions. And what if you see a video response on that Facebook group, then what that means is a lot of people are asking about that or interested in that. And I've gone for the video answer because it's faster, gives more information for the allowable time. So there you go. That was our Saturday, and this has been our Thursday. So congratulations for being here. Let's go to questions. We don't have a lot of time for questions, but we always need to allow time for that. You know what you need to do. If you have a question or a thought or a contribution or anything you'd like to say tonight, you have to put your hand up. You'll find that little blue hand in your control panel somewhere. And you just click on that. That will show up on my screen. I can call out your name and say, how about you talk to us? And you can say hello and we can have a chat and we can go from there. So hands up if you've got something that you want to say or ask about, and we will hop straight into it. Over to you guys. Hilton. Hey, mate. You have to unmute yourself.
I'm unmuted.
Aha, there you go.
Yes, the challenge, one of the points you made there was about going through, I'll call it failure, and looking at what's next, if you like, or what's success. Mm-hmm. And that's a major point for me right at the moment. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it means. I'm just sharing that dilemma at the moment.
Yeah, well, I would say that we all do it. We all go through it. That what we have to be really careful about is judgment about failure. What most of us do is take failure personally instead of learn from it. If you can take the lessons out of failure, then what happens is that you enrich yourself. many people will admire you because of your failure, whereas you might actually decrease admiration for yourself because of the failure. And certainly, you know, when I was running Entrepreneurs Masterclass for the 5 years or so we ran it, I used to encourage people to fail quickly because, you know, if you could, the quicker you could fail, the quicker you could get to the point where you'd find the thing that might work better for you. So be really careful about self-judgment when it comes to failure. Success, I think, you know, success is a bit overrated as well.
Life has to be lived irrespective of whether it's failure or success. It just goes on.
Yeah, and therefore the quality of your life depends on what you make of whether you are having a success or a failure this particular week or month or year.
Yeah, so that's, okay. Because the failure indicates to me, well, I'm already thinking, okay, what's tomorrow? What does 2020 bring?
Yeah, we can't know.
No, the one thing I do see is that completing this exercise at the moment, which I'm classifying as a failure, actually I can see opens up space for other things.
Yes.
Those other things are unknown.
They're unknown and quite often they're better. So, you know, I quite often refer to my friend the farmer. So I've got a client who, you know, I haven't seen him for 5 or 6 years. I quite often refer to people I haven't seen for a long time as clients because in my view, once a client, always a client. But, you know, this guy was struggling with this idea and he bought a Harley and I said, why did you buy the Harley, mate? And he said, well, because you all got one and you look like you're happy. You know, bit of a dumbass thing to do. But anyway, I said to him, look, mate, if you ride your Harley across the Nullarbor Plains, because he was talking about doing that, and I said, and the front tyre blows out and you go over the handlebars and you break your leg and you're lying there on the ground and you've got a broken leg and the Harley's all smashed up and that's when you discover it's not insured and you've probably written it off and you're in a lot of pain and all that sort of stuff. Is that good or is that bad? And he goes, obviously that's bad, mate. He said, it's like when it doesn't rain, that's bad. And this guy farms about 25,000 acres, right? So big, big farming, big, big gambler, really, because they've got to plant stuff and then wait and see if it rains. So he said, obviously that's bad. And I said, but what if the car that pulls up to help you, what, you know, so someone pulls over the side of the road and they help you and they come and help you. What if the person in that car is a woman who becomes your wife and you spend the rest of your life happily married, 3 kids? And he goes, oh, could you stop fucking with my head? And the reality is he had to go through that to find the great thing. And that's what you're saying is the unknowable. But quite often the unknowable is way better than what we're imagining it might be.
Yes. Well, one thing I can see, it's a relief.
Uh-huh. Well, relief is a wonderful thing, mate.
I'm already sensing that. I've just got to work through the next couple of weeks and that'll be it.
Cool. There's a burden off your shoulders and, yeah, frees up the future, hey?
It does. That's right. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Awesome. Well done, mate. Well done. Well done. Any other questions, thoughts, whatever?
From me or anybody? Anybody.
Oh, from me. Sorry, from anybody, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's wrap it, gang. So I would like to finish with something a little bit official, and that boils down to we are so looking forward to what we've got on offer next year that we're deep into the planning of it. So we'll reveal all of that to you as it comes up. Right now, I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to be of service to you and bring to you what it is that we do. Because without you being willing consumers of that, then, you know, I get to do it by myself, which I probably would, but it's much more enjoyable when we've got willing and grateful clients. And so I'm extremely grateful for you guys being there and turning up and participating in the way that you have, because this is one of my favorite things to do. You know, the whole elite thing has brought me up to another level. So I want to thank you that, and I want to wish you all a fabulous Christmas, a happy new year. I hope Santa Claus is great to you.
No, it's just not too good. This call and my phone from you, but maybe you.
Okay, so that's it from me, gang. Thank you for being with us this year. It's been a delight to be of service to you, and I feel privileged and honoured that you've let me into your life in the way that you have, and I'm looking forward to stepping up our game next year. Meanwhile, good night, God bless, happy Christmas. See you in the new year.
Sam says Merry Christmas and thank you.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Thanks, Paul and Mary.
Thank
you. Good night, all. Merry Christmas.
Good night, all. Merry Christmas.